Previously on Beta.
Now let's see who the ghost really is.
Oh, thank you, bless you. I need to go to a hospital. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Looks like your evil car killed another one, Mr. King.
What a tragedy. We've lost one of America's authors.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, the great guitarist, singer-songwriter Richard Thompson joins us to talk about his memoir, B-Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975.
You could almost say it's a memo to myself when I sing that song, is don't hold back, take risks. This is music. You can't play safe in music.
Also, the acclaimed novelist Rachel Kushner on her latest book, The Hard Crowd, Essays 2000 to 2020.
It gives an account of who I was before I became a writer. When I went to look at it, I thought, this is all so extreme. You know, was I exaggerating? I mean, I do make my living professionally by exaggerating in the form of fiction.
But first.
And the guy was like repeating over and over, like, we have to warn everybody, we have to warn everybody. He believed he had just seen three bodies dead, mangled, torn to pieces. He started to say something loud and was shushed. And then he said, I'm telling you, man, a Bigfoot killed those guys.
That's a clip from the gripping Hulu docuseries Sasquatch. The series starts out as a ghost story, but then it subtly shapeshifts and becomes a true crime documentary. You could say that the people behind this documentary have invented a new kind of genre. And because of this innovation, Sasquatch grabs the viewer's attention and holds it. That's no small feat in this attention economy in which we now live. Joshua Rofe is the director of Sasquatch. He joined us to talk about the dangers involved in filming in the lawless woods of Northern California and how exactly he got involved in this mythical project.
In February 2018, a buddy of mine, his name's Zach Kreger, he's one of the exec producers on this show, actually. He had mentioned a podcast that he thought I should listen to, which is called Sasquatch Chronicles. And Sasquatch Chronicles is people calling up with their Sasquatch encounter stories. And so, and to be honest with you, I wasn't interested when he mentioned that. But he pushed, and so I listened to an episode.
Was it a person or an animal? Or
I can't tell. All I know is that my sensor light came on, and I just happened to glimpse and see this thing running across the yard, a good-sized man or something. It looks like a man. I don't know what it was, just that it ran across the yard.
Okay. You've had problems in the neighborhood?
And then cut to 4 days later, and I'd listened to 11 episodes. And what I was really struck by was what I perceived as authentic, visceral fear that was being expressed and experienced by these people who were calling in with their Sasquatch encounter stories. For the next week, I sort of just had a conversation with myself, which essentially consisted of convincing myself that my next project was going to be Sasquatch-centric in some way. And by the end of the week, what I'd arrived at was that if I could find a murder mystery that was somehow wrapped up in a Sasquatch story, then I could really be onto something special. I did what you would do if you were me, which is I reached out to my friend David Holthaus. And I say that because David is my friend and colleague who has been a gonzo journalist and investigative journalist for over 25 years. He's the guy to reach out to if you're looking for a wild story. I sent him a text, and the text literally said, hey, this is the craziest text I'm going to send you for the next 5 years. I want to find a murder mystery that is somehow wrapped up in a Sasquatch story. And if it exists, pursue it as the next project. And he wrote me right back and he said, I love it. I got one. I'll call you in five.
Can you tell us quickly what the story was that David told you?
Yeah, sure. So the story that he then proceeded to tell me was in the fall of 1993, he was a young gonzo journalist who was burning in at both ends, learning the hard way that not everybody gets to be Hunter S. Thompson, and he needed to escape his current set of circumstances. And so he reached out to a friend of his who was working on a cannabis farm in Northern California, and that friend invited him out to get away. And so when David got there, you know, he thought he was going to be arriving at a pretty mellow, relaxing, you know, location to let things calm down for a week. And it was a terrifying energy that was in the air from the moment he arrived. And David's second night there, he was in an A-frame cabin that was owned by this cannabis farm owner. And there was a phone call.
The conversation is a little tense. I mean, I remember him saying, like, you guys on a run? You got everything sorted? You know, he's like, okay. And he's like, all right, but keep him mellow. You got to keep him mellow. About 15, 20 minutes later, see the headlights of a truck outside. These two guys come in, they're soaked, they're muddy, and one of them was talking a mile a minute. His eyes are like the eyes of a panicked horse, you know, they're rolling around. I was sketched out enough by this guy's presence that I was just kind of trying to become one with the couch.
They were terrified, they were exasperated, and they said that further up the mountain, there were three people who had been murdered, and all the eyewitnesses had the same account, and that was that they had been torn limb from limb by a Sasquatch. And so this was the story that young 23-year-old Gonzo journalist David Holthouse heard in 1993, and he had certainly never forgotten it, but it just seemed it was too absurd to bring to any editors at any of the papers that he worked for. But then when I came knocking and sort of, you know, that was, you know, really sort of, you know, reawoken within him, you know, both he and I knew that we wanted to pursue it.
Yeah, it was like kismet for sure. A lot of the myth of Bigfoot is focused in Northern California, specifically this area, these three counties known as the Emerald Triangle. What is it about this area that sustains the legend of Bigfoot?
I think it's the woods out there. I think it's the forest. I mean, when you're out in those woods, it feels prehistoric. And you get a few miles deep in those woods and you forget what life is like back in the city or the suburbs. It's transportive. It really is. And so I think if you're out in the woods and you want to find something, that's a place where you can really sort of lose yourself. Everything about that setting lends itself to the folklore.
I mean, someone doesn't have to be an amphetamine addict to have been out in the woods maybe too long and been traumatized by being out there and fearing for their lives. I feel like all the Sasquatch stories I ever heard emanates from that traumatic feeling of like, I might not belong here and something is gonna take me out.
Yeah, this area is also extremely dangerous and has this very sordid history of genocide, racism, and murder. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, those were really interesting discoveries and chilling discoveries to make along the way. We set out to pursue really the source, the origin point of this Sasquatch murder mystery, and we didn't realize how dangerous things were going to get.
Now, private investigator that I hired kind of disappeared for a couple weeks. And then he just came across with this text that was like, A, saying that he quit, and B, like, you are venturing into dangerous territory with this investigation. He won't return my phone calls, he won't return my texts, he won't answer my emails, like, nothing.
The criminal element there, the underworld, those woods that I mentioned a second ago, this criminal element is so pervasive in those woods, and it's pretty lawless. There are not enough police officers, law enforcement agents to corral or control what's going on out there. It's the Wild West. It really is. You start to go further up the mountain in certain areas and there's nobody to keep the peace. It's the locals who lay down what the law is. And if somebody feels that you've crossed them in any way or done something that is not acceptable according to the way things work up there, you're going to get killed and nobody's even going to know where to look for you.
Yeah, and the epicenter of within the Emerald Triangle, the epicenter of all this violence and danger and lawlessness seems to be this area called Spy Rock Road. Can you tell us a bit about Spy Rock Road?
Yes, I mean, Spy Rock was a place that once we started talking to locals or people who had lived there previously or just done any research, you know, even online, it became clear that Spy Rock's a pretty lawless place and outsiders are not welcome. It's not the place to just go wandering up searching for information. But then Of course, that's exactly what we did, and David Holthouse specifically.
Would Spy Rock be a dangerous place for my crew and I to just, like, go and start trying to get interviews?
I definitely wouldn't advise you go up to Spy Rock trying to figure anything out unless you have an invitation. Spy Rock's the kind of place where it's not really a good idea to go ride around asking questions.
How has the government over the years dealt with all the lawlessness in the Emerald Triangle?
The war on drugs was really in full steam in the early 80s through the early 90s.
This week, law enforcement authorities have moved into Humboldt County in a major raid to begin chopping down and clearing out the clandestine croplands.
And so, you know, the government was very much trying to dictate how things were going to go out there. But as time has gone on, I think it's just a place that it polices itself. And I know at least local law enforcement, I mean, some of them even said in our show that there's only so much they can do.
We probably have more bodies than we could even count right now up in the hills.
A lot of unreported murders.
Oh, I'm sure there are. You know, a lot of unsolved, it's pretty bad. And it's not because we're not trying, it's because we don't have the cooperation from the community on a lot of them. Especially with marijuana grows, you know, who's going to be willing to talk to us?
It's not as though this is a place where there's roads with names and, you know, make a left on this and a right on this, and then you'll get to the area where that dead body might be. It's make a left at that tree stump, go 300 yards. There are no roads at a certain point. It's just sort of these dirt pathways that you got to have the right vehicle. You wouldn't even know where to look. You wouldn't even know how to get there, even if you were told.
Were you and David and the rest of the crew ever concerned for your safety?
Always, actually. Except when we were filming with the people from the Sasquatch community or some of the people who had previously lived in that area when they wanted to just get off the grid and get back to the land. Filming with all those folks was totally safe, and they were all really wonderful, warm, welcoming people. But when we were exploring, you know, the other and really larger element of this series, which was this sort of backwoods underworld, we were constantly aware of the fact that we were not safe and that we were already overstaying our welcome just by way of setting foot there.
I mean, look, with these kinds of investigations, I'm still alive because I do a constant risk analysis, okay? And my risk analysis in regards to this individual is don't put his name out in the public. It's not worth the risk. So as far as I'm concerned, he's alleged killer only, and alleged killer he will remain.
On top of that, there were experiences David had where, you know, no camera could go with him. I couldn't go with him. Nobody can go with him. And it's just him going to meet with a new source who potentially has information about this alleged triple homicide. And locations get changed on David. People are pressuring him to get in cars to go drive in the middle of the night 3 hours away to some random cabin in the woods. It was harrowing at times. It was crazy.
Do you have concerns about your safety now that the series is finished and public?
No. I think we did a good job of concealing certain identities that could put people at risk potentially, and I don't think we're thinking about that much.
Yeah. Do you think your series could help get to the bottom of this 1993 triple murder?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, the culture up there really is one of silence. But it is possible that things will get shaken up. I'm not saying it's likely, but I think anything's possible.
There is this elusive truth that I glimpsed, you know, through the trees. And it's like the same obsession that drives squatchers to spend half their lives in the woods. They do it because they're obsessed. They're convinced that they're always just one step away from getting the proof they need, right? Am I just doing the same shit? Am I just like out there running around the woods, like convinced that I'm just one move away from like really cracking this case and being able to explain exactly what happened in 1993?
One of the most intriguing things I thought about your documentary is the docuseries is that you're kind of inventing a new genre, the way you're marrying the ghost story and true crime. It's kind of like you've created your own niche genre. What do you think?
Oh, well, wow, that was amazing. That's amazing to hear. Thank you. It is funny because we used to say to each other when we were starting out, we're chasing a ghost story. We're investigating a ghost story. And that, at times, that just leaves you feeling like you're getting nowhere. But then all of a sudden, when you start to have breakthroughs 6 months, 8 months, a year into the investigation, suddenly you start to have this experience where you realize that if you dig at a ghost story, not all of them, but it's got to be the right one, obviously, and tough to identify that ahead of time even. But if you dig at a ghost story for long enough, you might actually get to something that is even scarier and wilder than you anticipated. And I know that's what our experience was making this. And so, I mean, I hope that people can have even sort of half of that experience watching it.
Joshua Roffe is the director of the Hulu docuseries Sasquatch. You can find out more about Joshua and Sasquatch at wpr.org/beta.
And this started us on a whole quest, really, to blend more British traditional music with contemporary instruments, with electric instruments.
Coming up, singer-songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson talks about the early days of his great career. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The finest rock songwriter after Dylan and the best electric guitarist since Hendrix. That's how the Los Angeles Times describes Richard Thompson. I'm certainly not going to argue with that. I would add that he also has a beautiful and very powerful singing voice. Richard was a vital part of the late 60s folk scene in England as a valuable member of Fairport Convention. He also recorded 6 albums with his then-wife, Linda Thompson. Richard recently released a memoir called B-Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975, which he wrote with Scott Timberg. Beta's own Steve Gotcher sat down with Richard to talk about the early years of his career and why the book is called B-Swing.
B-Swing is the title of a song, and it's a song of mine that, to my mind, encapsulates some of the things I felt about the 1960s and into the 1970s. So it seemed good thematically to be a title for the book. It's about people really dropping out, people not taking the path well-traveled, people not going into the family business, people not getting jobs in banks and accountancy firms, but people really not going to university, dropping out, becoming drug dealers, becoming drug addicts in some cases, you know, joining communes, all that kind of thing. Taking to the road as well, you know, becoming itinerant. And I thought, you know, the song is a bit like that as well. It's about people really falling through the safety net almost of society. So I thought it was a good reflection of the book.
I understand that you have your guitar handy. Is that true?
It could be true if I lean backwards. Yes. What can I do for you in that sense?
Well, I was told that you would play a little bit of B-Swing for us.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Okay. I was 19 when I came to town. They caught the summer of love. They were burning babies, burning flags, the hawks against the doors. I took a job in the steamy down on Cardram Street. I fell in love with a laundry girl who was working next to me. Oh, she was a rare thing, fine as a bee's wing. So fine a breath of wind might blow her away. She was a lost child, she was running wild. She said, as long as there's no price on love, I'll stay. And you wouldn't want me any other way. etc.
Excellent. Thank you very much. How did the guitar become your instrument of choice?
When I was growing up, it was all guitars, you know. First of all, my father had really good guitar records. He had Les Paul records. He had Django Reinhardt records. He had Lonnie Johnson records, of all things. And so I had that from that end of the spectrum. And then my sister, my big sister, was buying rock and roll records when I was still quite young. So I was hearing Elvis and hearing, Buddy Holly, a lot of Buddy Holly. The guitar seemed like something that I should do myself, you know. It's this very sexy thing, so I thought I should get a guitar. And I started pestering my parents from probably about the age of six, actually. And they fobbed me off with toys, really, until a real one appeared in the house when I was about 10. And then I kind of took to it like a duck to water and took classical lessons and then just played by ear and got an electric guitar when I was probably about 12 and took it from there.
You know, you talk a lot about other musical styles. You talked about your father's music. You talked about the rock and roll that your sister played for you. You have a lot of musical influences that you've worked very hard to incorporate into the music that you do. Now, a lot of musicians lock into a particular type like pop or metal and stay with that style. But why do you think that it was necessary to try to blend styles?
I'm not sure it was a conscious thing. I just loved certain kinds of music. I love jazz from all eras, you know. So starting with my father's records, I heard some of that. And then I got into, you know, Coltrane, Albert Eiler, people like that. I love classical music, mostly 20th century stuff. I love what you call roots music. And I grew up with, you know, Celtic music, listening to that. And somehow it all kind of worked in together. And I realized, you know, when I was playing electric guitar as a teenager, bits of all that stuff were creeping in without me really thinking about it.
Is the blending of styles something you're still striving for in the music that you're doing today?
I think I have a style now. I think it's established. And when you have a style, you can bring in other things to it. And you don't sound like you're a musical colonialist or a dilettante. You know, it becomes you. But
right.
You can be inspired by things from outside your genre, I think, all the time. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, that's happened across the whole history of music, really.
Now, your book covers a specific period. And I was curious why you picked 1967 to 1975. But once I finished the book, I realized it was a pivotal period for you. After that, you kind of got yourself set on a course. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I suppose so. 67 was the year that my band Fairbrook Convention turned professional. And, you know, that was a big step forward. And then it was really lots of things happening to us very quickly. We were getting lots of work immediately, making records very quickly. And it was a time, one of those times in music, a bit like the punk era or something, like when the floodgates open and lots of bands get signed up because the record industry doesn't quite understand what's going on and is struggling to catch up. So they tend to sign everything. And we were very fortunate in that way that we kind of rode in on this wave of psychedelia, even though we were not a psychedelic band. We rode in at the same time as Pink Floyd and the Soft Machine. And, you know, the Crazy World of Arthur Brown and The Move and lots of other bands at that time.
Yeah. It seems like Fairport Convention and that time, you were like a subculture of a subculture.
I think we were a subculture of a subculture of a subculture.
Okay.
I go even further. Yes, you could say that. I mean, we were coming through at a time when lots of music was accepted, though. So we weren't a blues band. There were lots of blues bands around at that time. We weren't a psychedelic band necessarily. Lots of that going on at the time. But, you know, the audience would accept you as they would accept the Incredible String Band, or they would accept, you know, Duster Bennett or Ivor Cutler, you know, more eccentric people as part of the whole picture. And they'd sit and listen to you and they'd applaud you. It was very egalitarian. It was very open, really. Perhaps an unusual time in music.
Yeah, and you say in the book that you didn't really catch on in a huge way, but you wanted to stay true to the music that you wanted to play, and you did that. And you didn't compromise, it seems, ever, even to this day.
I think that's a fair assessment. We were always determined as a band to be different, to be individual. And We loved roots music, so we were always reflecting our interest in that. And we loved lyrics. We loved the great songwriters. Where we loved Phil Oakes and we loved Bob Dylan and we loved Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell. So in our early incarnations, before we really started writing, we would cover these singer-songwriters.
Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend
When the birds started doing Dylan songs or something, that was a real inspiration for us. And ultimately, when we started writing our own music, then that became a whole other thing.
A very amazing thing happened when, just before your second album, Sandy Denny joined your band. How did she change the band's sound? What was her contribution?
She was a fantastic singer. So right at the front of the band, you had someone who was so good that... you couldn't help but play better. You couldn't help but be elevated by her skill as a singer. She was a wonderful singer, but just wonderful communicator of a song to an audience. And when Sandy joined the band, she had been playing in folk clubs, and we thought that we, because we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time, we kind of molded ourselves around some of Sandy's acoustic arrangements, and some of those were traditional songs, and this started us on a whole quest really to blend more British traditional music with contemporary instruments, with electric instruments, and that started us off, you know, on our mission, if you like.
My young love said to me,
on the album Unhalfbricking, you guys did a song that turned out to be 11 minutes long called A Sailor's Tale. And in the book you say you recorded that in one take. And it's one of the most compelling pieces on the album. How did the process of getting it in one take happen?
This was a song that Sandy knew. So Sandy had been singing it in folk clubs. It's called A Sailor's Life. And we did it live, like I think twice. Really just jamming, you know, in that real 60s style, you know. So we start out singing the song and it goes through five or six verses, and then we play a kind of instrumental long passage at the end of it. We thought we should record it, and so we got Dave Swarbrick in, a wonderful traditional fiddler, and we just said, really, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start out of time, then we're going to kick into tempo and play this instrumental passage, and then see you at the end, basically. And that was about it in terms of preparation. And, you know, we just played it once and it sounded really good. And we thought, well, that's it. There's no point doing it again. I think we've absolutely cracked it. I mean, it was just a lucky performance, really.
1972 was a turning point for you. You left Fairport Convention, and you recorded your first solo album, the critically acclaimed Henry the Human Fly, and you met and married Linda Peters, and together you recorded six albums. Is there any one in particular that you're most proud of?
Well, I think the first one, I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, is probably the best one. Just in terms of songs, I think it has a really good selection of songs. Some of those songs I still sing to this day. And I think it was one of those records, again, it's a lucky record. It got recorded very quickly. I think we recorded it in 3 days. Everything went to plan. It's very unusual on a record. I think it cost the princely sum of £2,500 to record, which is, you know, unheard of, really, you know, including all the musicians' fees, overdubs, and all that kind of stuff. Because of the way it was recorded, because of the lack of tricks on the record, you know, the lack of sort of trendy compression or phasing or flanging or anything, it sounds good today. You know, it hasn't dated too much.
Eventually, you came to embrace Islam, and you wrote, "It's like coming home after a long journey, that this is who you had always been." And then Linda embraced Islam a few months later. How did Islam change your lives?
Pretty drastically, I should say. I think you just acknowledge certain things about yourself, and you acknowledge some connection with, you know, the, whatever you want to call it, the, like the great spirit or the universe or something, and you affirm that connection. But in doing that, you lose some friends sometimes. You know, I realized, you know, when I stopped drinking, which I did like almost immediately, that some people you'd never really spent time with sober, and you didn't really like them. So some friends fell by the wayside. I'm sure that we irritated a lot of people, you know, being kind of, you know, newly different, if you like. So it was a transitional period, really, the first couple of years. But then I think we've kind of figured out how to interact with our old friends a bit better. And it became just an everyday thing.
The last album that you and Linda recorded together was Shoot Out the Lights, and it was released in 1982. It features one of your most powerful songs called Wall of Death. What can you tell me about that song?
So the Wall of Death, it's a motorcycle ride, you know, where you start off vertical and you end up horizontal on the motorcycle. The song also mentions other fairground rides. There was a famous seaside fairground, and all the rides were in this particular fairground. So it's a kind of a nod to that particular place, and I think almost to another era, so kind of a 1950s era. But for me, it's a song about taking risks, and you could almost say it's a memo to myself when I sing that song, is don't hold back, take risks. This is music. You can't play safe in music.
I wanted to circle back and ask you a question about the end of your book. You ended your book talking about Sandy Denny and the tragedy of her last few years. Why did you want to end the book there?
Well, the book's really concerned about the years 67 to 75, and everything after that is really an afterword. It's really just trying to tie up loose ends for the reader, really. And I thought it was important to say that Sandy, you know, deteriorated after that time and died, you know, at the age of 31. I thought it was important to say that. I said about Nick Drake as well, how young he died. Talk about, you know, the breakup of my marriage with Linda very briefly. Just so people had more of a complete picture without me having to write about the next few years necessarily, which I found mostly not that interesting to write about. So I stopped, I think, at the right time. I stopped in 75, and I just wanted to really catch up after that.
Richard Thompson, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Richard Thompson is the author of Bee Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Steve Gotcher talked with him. You can find out more about Richard and the early years of his career at WPR.org/beta. When the spell is broken.
There is a certain kind of reduction in the prose, like a sameness, where after you've read 1,100 pages of it, you feel like you drank 10 gallons of chocolate milk or something.
Author Rachel Kushner talks about Cormac McCarthy's Border Trilogy and some other subjects that she explores in her essay collection, The Hard Crowd. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The person who writes about her experience is not the same person who had the experience. The ability to write about it is proof of change, of great distance. Not everyone is willing to admit this, but it's true. In all a writer's supposed self-exposure, her claim to authentic experience, the thing the writer omits reporting on is her galling idea that her life might become a subject put to paper, might fill the pages of a book.
That's Rachel Kushner reading an excerpt from the title essay of her collection, The Hard Crowd, Essays 2000 to 2020. Kushner is the author of the critically acclaimed novels The Flamethrowers and The Mars Room. The Flamethrowers was a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction 2013, and The Mars Room was shortlisted for the 2018 Man Booker Prize. The Hard Crowd collects 19 essays written over the last 20 years. They demonstrate that Rachel is as comfortable and sharp with her nonfiction as she is with her novels. We caught up with Rachel at her home in Los Angeles to talk about The Hard Crowd and how her writing strikes the perfect balance of propulsive entertainment and intellectual heft.
I'm not thinking of a specific reader when I write, ever. And I think it's because I don't feel that that would be an effective approach for me as much as trying to please myself. A pretty stern judge is an approach that works for me as a strategy. So in trying to please myself, I think I'm balancing a lot of different things in terms of wanting the writing to have a kind of verve and energy and, you know, even to be like a little bit crude or hopefully kind of sexy, but also deal with things and employ a rigor that challenges me and brings me to a level of understanding that I did not possess when I sat down to write the thing.
That makes a lot of sense. You use the words energy and verve, and those seem to be a big part of your writing style, to me anyway. How would you describe your writing style?
You know, it's hard when you're the writer. It's like, what do you see when you look in the mirror? Whatever I see is probably pretty interpolated by a lifetime of figuring out, you know, what I want to see, what I like and don't like. In terms of voice and writing, I think that for better or worse, my writing does all seem to have a kind of recognizable voice or tone to it. And it hasn't changed that much over the years, which isn't to say it's static at all. I'm always learning new things, especially in the realm of fiction writing and how to approach the puzzle of the novel. In terms of my essays, you know, the first one in the book was published 20 years ago, and the tone of it is not that different from how I write now, even if there are details and scenes in that essay that I absolutely would not be able to conjure now had I not written down those details and scenes when I was much closer to the time in my life when they occurred. But in terms of like coming up with descriptors, I really don't know. I hear from people that it's a little bit dense in the sense that I try to pack a lot into the sentence and then maybe let the next sentence begin with a new idea rather than kind of filling things in an airy way. I'm always looking for where to cut and clip to sort of freight a lot of meaning in a short space of time.
Yeah. The final sentences of your essays made a very strong impression on me. And you've said that you like the radical cut, like film over. Can you explain what you mean by that?
In terms of my essays, I think I do like a kind of hard cut at the end that sometimes involves a sort of swerve, whether in logic or tone. And I really enjoyed having the opportunity to re-examine the essays that I chose for the book. They all had to kind of be talking to one another. So I only chose maybe like a third of or a quarter of the essays that I've written that I feel would be good enough to fit into some kind of book. as I started opening them up and looking at them and kind of subjecting them to new changes, each individually as a discrete entity, and also according to how they spoke to one another so that there weren't repetitions and that so that things could sort of echo in thematics and, you know, sort of return, I saw in a few places that I could completely change the ending and put a new ending. And sometimes it took me by surprise what that ending ended up being. But there are a few that I would say have a more hard cut. Like at the end of this essay about Cormac McCarthy's Border Trilogy, the ending of the first of that Border Trilogy, All the Pretty Horses, there's this very strange image that McCarthy uses of the young cowboy riding up through the mountains of northern Mexico as he returns to Texas. And he pales into the landscape is the language that McCarthy has chosen for that. And so then in the original essay, I had talked about the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and maybe that language kind of auguring death or suggesting death. And then when I did my revision, I just wrote, he is death, capital D. And then that's the end of the essay. And I think it takes a few passes at an essay, maybe over a few years, to come to a really hard ending and feel like it's appropriate, because that just wouldn't have occurred to me when I was first writing the essay.
Yeah, you mentioned that particular scene in McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses as one of your favorite moments in literature. Can you tell us a bit, you touched on it, but can you tell us a bit more about this scene and why it means so much to you?
Well, really just for the reasons that I cited.
Mm-hmm.
As I say in the essay, he's doing something with the whole history of the myth of the frontier and the promise of the frontier and this idea of an American Adam, meaning, you know, a sort of pure and innocent spirit who gets to come to this, you know, unmarked blank canvas and stake out a new life. Of course, we all know that this is not a blank canvas, the United States of America. Many people had been living here for tens of thousands of years. And in order to make it blank, our, you know, founding fathers employed genocide. So by the time you get to the end of that book, this idea of this boy paling into the landscape suggests that he has undergone a haunting transfiguration into a figure that augurs death. And to me, it's a really magnificent moment. I also think that Cormac McCarthy is a fantastic writer, especially his early, like his first five novels. I mean, the Border mm-hmm. Trilogy I like. It's not my absolute favorite. There is a certain kind of reduction in the prose, like a sameness where after you've read 1,100 pages of it, you feel like you drank 10 gallons of chocolate milk or something.
yeah.
But I really do love that closing moment at the end of the first book because it is so haunting. But he's done a lot of work to poke holes in myths before he gets there, so that when he comes around to something darker with more gravitas, he's not relying on romanticism to get there. He's already shot this romantic myth of the West full of holes.
Yeah, very well said. The opening essay in The Hard Crowd is Girl on a Motorcycle. Can you tell us a bit about this essay?
I wrote this essay about an illegal road race spanning the length of the Baja Peninsula. It starts at the border into Tijuana at San Ysidro, which is south of San Diego. This race no longer exists and was highly illegal. But the idea behind it was that it started at the border below San Diego and went all the way to the tip of Baja, Cabo San Lucas, which is about 1,100 miles. And the idea behind this race is that you're supposed to finish it in one day, meaning less than 24 hours. So the essay is about that race, and it's about my experience riding in that race, which I only did once. And when I wrote it, I had still remembered the details of it were very fresh in my mind in terms of things like what I did to my own Kawasaki Ninja 600, how I prepped the bike, who was on the race with me, et cetera, et cetera. But I, when I went to look at that essay, I knew I wanted it to open this collection and be the first thing, not because it was the first thing I published, but because it gives an account of who I was before I became a writer. When I went to look at it, I thought, this is all so extreme. You know, was I exaggerating? I mean, I do make my living professionally by exaggerating in the form of fiction. So I wanted to sort of run it by a couple of friends and let them tell me if the piece was realistic, because it all seemed pretty unbelievable. And I gave it to two people who still work and live in the world of motorcycles. One is a Ducati crew chief and the other builds land speed vehicles that he runs at the Bonneville Soft Flats. And they'd both been on that race and said, no, this is right. And this is what it was. So I'm really glad I wrote those things down when I did.
It's very powerful. My wife, Catherine, is really into motorcycles, but I'm not really interested in them at all. But the way you're writing in that essay made me very interested. So that was very well done. In your closing essay, the title essay, The Hard Crowd, you mentioned Charles Wilford's 1955 novel, Pickup. And I've read that this book is an influence on your work. How so?
I discovered this novel, Pickup, on somebody else's bookshelves, which is the way I sometimes do my best reading, in that it's not a book I would have known to look at. And I started reading it one night and was just totally mesmerized by this book, which takes place in San Francisco at mid-century. And it's the story of these two alcoholics, a man and a woman, who spend a lot of their time drinking. I mean, in a way, they kind of remind me of Piper Laurie and Paul Newman in that great movie, The Hustler.
You talk kind of funny, but I like it.
I used to be an actress.
Yeah, what do you do now?
I'm a college girl. 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, I go to college.
Don't look like a college girl.
I'm the emancipated type. Real emancipated.
No, I didn't mean that. Whatever that means. I mean, you just don't look young enough.
I'm not.
So why go to college?
Got nothing else to do on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
What are you doing the other days?
I drink.
Piper Laurie and Paul Newman are these two really lost, depressed people who drink and kind of sustain each other until they can't anymore. And Pickup is kind of like that too. And it takes place in a part of San Francisco, the Civic Center, where I spent a lot of time in my adolescence and actually write about in the title essay, The Hard Crowd, of this book.
Mm-hmm. We talked to crime novelist George Pelicanos here on Beta a few years ago, and he said that one of the things that he likes about Pickup is the ambiguous approach that Wilford took to the protagonist's race.
So the very last line of the novel is describes him as a tall, lonely Negro walking in the rain. Hmm. He's black. And you don't know it until the end of the book.
Is that one of the things about Pickup that intrigues you?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's so interesting that that George Pelicanos talked about Pickup. I actually got a note from him after he read The Mars Room, just out of the blue. And he was so complimentary. I was kind of blown away, because I'm not, you know, somebody who has focused on plotting in the way that a writer like he has done so. But if the book met with his approval, I was deeply flattered. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. He really likes Pickup. There's a Dorothy Hughes novel called The Expendable Man that mm-hmm. does something similar to what Charles Wilford's Pickup does in terms of shocking and deepening and totally logical thematic of race. And both books did that, and are, I think, kind of from similar eras. And, you know, if somebody was interested, they could write something really fascinating by putting those two books into sort of a comparison and distinction.
Interesting. So I should probably read both of those books. Thank you very much, Rachel Kushner. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for reading my book and asking questions. Nice to talk to you as well.
Rachel Kushner is the author of The Hard Crowd, Essays, 2000 to 2020. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Joshua Rofe, Richard Thompson, and Rachel Kushner. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
So I was hooked from that moment on. That's how I lost my job and my friends.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I don't care how big, ugly, and smelly you are.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Please be safe out there. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
But I'm sure you'll see that as soon as he gets going, there is absolutely nothing to stop him.